Hi, my name is Scott.
And I am Zach.
Welcome back to Learning Grounds.
Episode 6, in which we talk with Liz.
Liz is a student in the learning and teaching cohort at the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
She's also fluent in German, a wonderful fiddler or violinist, depending on what she's playing. And she talked to us about the way her brain thinks about learning music and learning language. And Scott got to jump in there, too, with how he thinks about learning music and language. And I got to jump in there to ask questions because I don't really speak any other languages or play music.
He is a very, very charming gentleman, however.
I am charming. I talked about how I learned charm. So if you have, I know that was horrible, right? If you have a cup of coffee and some time, this is a podcast that is how long?
It's one cup of coffee long.
So thank you very much and welcome to Learning Grounds.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome to another episode of Learning Grounds.
With Scott and Zach.
Yes, our coffees are not unusually... For us, it's pretty
standard.
Actually, Liz, you bring a variety to the coffee.
Oh, do I?
Well, I mean, that's the nice thing about having a guest.
Right.
We're pretty boring people, generally.
Yeah. So it's Starbucks again. I have a grande blonde, but not in my usual cup, which makes me sad. I've killed the planet a little bit today.
A little bit today, just like I do every week.
Scott, what do you have?
I have a decaf with hazelnut without cream, once again. I prefer cream. Looking at us and just hit a parking meter. So what we're noticing, see, we happen to be in a very interesting space today.
I'm loving this space.
For those people who are not able to experience the multimedia room in Gutman, we're now in a different room on the first floor, one of the study rooms, and it looks out on Appian Way.
Right.
And there are...
Appian Way in Cambridge,
in
Massachusetts.
Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Not the Appian Way.
Right, right. And
in ancient Rome.
And there are many newly admitted students to the Harvard Graduate School of Education here today. And many of them are kind of walking along. We get to people watch. If I get distracted...
I'll just slap you upside the head.
Right, that's fair.
So our guest this week is Liz.
Hi, Liz.
Liz, what are you drinking?
I am drinking, I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit, a soy latte.
Why are you embarrassed?
There's no embarrassment.
It's a little bit embarrassing.
It's two shots of hazelnut.
Yeah, I am a wuss.
It might not be as embarrassing.
Yeah, my coffee is as wussy as it comes.
But I did, I discovered this drink this summer when a friend of mine was visiting from LA, and I think my association with this drink is with her from LA. And
so you're more embarrassed about LA.
Because they always have the soy lattes.
Yeah. I never have been to LA, but I am also slightly lactose intolerant, so I feel as though I really should be drinking a soy latte instead.
You're kind of like lactose inconsiderate.
Yeah.
Right. That's sort of what it is.
Liz, what program are you in here at the Harvard Graduate School of Education?
I'm in learning and teaching.
Cool.
Excellent.
Yeah. Actually, not what I applied for.
Really? What did you apply for?
I applied for the teacher education program.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I got my email saying, congratulations, you've been accepted into learning and teaching. And I really didn't understand what was going on. And I wrote to admissions saying, why was I accepted into a program I didn't apply for? And I was about 98% sure I was going to go to Penn because I got into their teacher ed program. But then Harvard was generous enough to give me a rather sizable scholarship, so I came here instead.
That's a good reason.
And I am actually very glad that I decided to do L&T instead of TEP.
And the difference between L&T, as I understand it, and teacher education program, L&T is to kind of deepen your understanding of what it is to be a teacher,
mm-hmm.
kind of,
yeah.
in a way. But it has no certification,
right.
no licensure at the end.
Right.
Teacher education program, you're a licensed teacher at the end.
Yeah, you're a licensed public teacher, and the emphasis is on urban schools. And while I think that would have been fine, it would have been great probably, mm-hmm. I am also glad to sort of feel I have the flexibility to work in other types of school as well. I don't think, frankly, that I'd be very well suited to teach in an urban public school. I mean, for instance, I was just saying I just had an interview this week at the German International School of Boston. I mean, I am interested in doing work in international schools, so I think that maybe the urban public and charter system would not have been the right for me.
Which is an important thing, because I think a lot of people try to force themselves
mm-hmm.
to fit, like, this is the role that people need teachers in, and it's...
And I felt bad for a while at the beginning, thinking, that's not for me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh shit, I'm a
it's
bad
okay.
person.
It's
all right.
All right. No one listens to the podcast.
Like, I'm a bad person. I, you know, should be fighting for equity and rights and all of it. And maybe I should, but I don't know if that's the role for me.
Well,
at least not now.
But I think also the argument is every kid needs a good
mm-hmm.
teacher or good teachers in
yeah.
their life. So it's just this moment of like, we shouldn't all funnel toward one place.
Yeah.
So
wait, can I ask a question? Because you called admissions
mm-hmm.
and you said I got accepted into a program I didn't apply for. What was their response to that?
They said it's a very complex process, and we thought that L&T would be a better fit for you. Which I thought was kind of presumptuous, like,
yeah.
how could you know what's
yeah.
a better fit for me? I applied to this. I wrote my essay about why this is the program that I want to be in, and now you say that it's a better fit. But I kind of think they may have been right.
Hmm. Or they made a mistake that ended up being right.
Yeah.
Does that happen a fair amount that people apply to?
What I remember is that on my Penn application, there was a box that I ticked saying, I would go into a different program if you thought it was a better fit, but I don't remember doing that for Harvard.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So some things I know about you
mm-hmm.
are, one, that you speak German
mm-hmm.
rather fluently,
mm-hmm.
or fluently,
mm-hmm.
not even no qualifier, and that you are also a fiddle player.
Mm-hmm.
That is outstanding.
Yeah. A fine fiddle player.
A fine fiddle player.
How long have you been playing? And so, first of all, fiddle versus violin, help me understand.
Well, I would have to say, I think I'm first and foremost a violinist.
Okay.
Was also.
Yeah, Zach.
Well, I don't know. I've only seen her play fiddle.
I was also kind of indoctrinated by my first teacher, who was absolutely one of the most influential people in my life, Mr. McAdam, David McAdam. This old English man who lived in Cowansville, Quebec, which is just across the border from where my parents live. I took lessons from him with him from the time I was 8 until I was 16. And just incredible, incredible person. But he was the first to say, you do not play the fiddle. And I think that I was probably kind of annoying as a little kid whenever people would say, oh, Elizabeth, you and the fiddle. It's not a fiddle, it's a violin.
No, good. So you get indoctrinated
totally,
right
easily.
Totally. But I've had to sort of rethink my ways recently because of my friend and fellow L&T-er, Tom, who from the very beginning expressed interest in playing music. I said that I play violin, and he said, oh, I play guitar and banjo, and would you like to jam sometime? And I don't know how many times in my life I've been asked this question, and it always sort of makes me shudder and turn the other way, this idea of jamming also sort of
evokes...
very
prim and proper, is it?
I mean, it sort of evokes the college hippie guitar circle thing that I've always been kind of a snob against. But at some point I was able to jump over my own shadow, and we finally, you know, just one night we were having a drink, and he just again sort of offhand was like, let's play music. And for whatever reason I said, okay, fine, let's just go. And had I given it a second longer thought, we wouldn't have done it. But we went, and that was sort of the beginning of the end. And I've been really getting into it. It's the first time in my life that I've never, so I've what, been playing for 18, almost 19 years. First time in my life that I've not used sheet music and really had to rely solely on my ear and sort of noticing chord progressions and playing along with it. And I'm getting better. I mean, I'm still not that great, but like, I'm definitely...
They're going to make a movie about you, I'm sure. Center stage, but with the violin. Like, and even this kind of hippie who's like, no, you play the fiddle. I can see it.
Now, are you playing with just this one person now, or are you expanding it to play with other people?
Well, we've expanded sort of the core to mm-hmm. include another guitarist. But we then also have these kind of what I call our mega jams, where we just invite people and everyone sort of, you know, picks up an instrument. Tom's got a couple string instruments. He's got a mandolin, ukulele, then we got two guitars, banjo, bunch of stuff. I'm the only one on strings, I'm the only one on fiddle. Though his girlfriend once came into town, she also plays fiddle, so we had two fiddles, which was really great. It was beautiful, beautiful sound. Then we've got an Irish friend who occasionally brings his penny whistle.
That's awesome.
and his Irish drum. So it's all pretty,
yeah,
pretty improvised, but it's super fun.
So let me then say, how, if at all, does this shape, like this experience, shape your thinking about education and how people and learning and teaching and shaping experiences for students?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the most obvious one, and I mean, I'm always scared when talking about education that I'm going to slip into cliche.
That's all right. Scott will call you on it.
Okay. I mean, I think the big thing here was the risk-taking. I mean, I think of myself as a student. I mean, working now, I teach German, and thinking of myself as a student in sort of middle and high schools, I was like a teacher's pet, like super kind of straight A, like hand always in the air, like did all my homework. I think conventional schooling worked quite well for me, which has also been a big challenge for me now as a teacher, trying to figure out how to get to reach kids who like couldn't give two shits about school or like who hate school, who, you know, hate learning in that conventional sense. I mean, hating learning I don't think can really exist, but and so as such, I mean, I've always sort of done well in this conventional way, I do get freaked out sometimes by taking risks like this. The other times that I had tried to jam with friends, I broke into cold sweats and
really?
Like completely froze. I remember two occasions. One was actually when I was in Germany on my semester abroad, sophomore year of college. It was these two dudes, actually one from Boulder, and so total hippie, so
yeah.
Guitar scene.
What I aspire to now.
And then this other dude, I guess he was from Nova Scotia. Strangest accent, actually. And it was just these two guitars, and we're sitting in the kitchen of our dorm, and they wanted to play Minor Swing, the Django and Grappelli tune, which, frankly, I mean, jazz violin is like another thing altogether, and I sort of like lost circulation to my arms and totally froze. Then another time I was playing with a really good friend of mine, but he's a very talented and experienced fiddler, and so I just sort of felt overshadowed, and I'm not sure exactly what it was. I mean, maybe it was just having drunk a couple beers, and you know, in this setting where it was really like low stress. We had another friend who was along who wasn't a musician at all.
You're talking about here recently.
Yeah, playing recently. And I don't know, I mean, I still sometimes when I make a mistake, I still feel like embarrassed and apologetic. But I think it's the fact that it's really clear to me that no one cares and that no one is judging me and that we just keep playing. And it's like I'm not alienating my friends and, you know, they don't think differently.
So is it apathy? Is it no one cares? Or is it that people care for you?
I think it's the latter.
Okay.
I think it's the latter. I think it's that people show that they care about me in wanting to play music. Mm-hmm. It's this investment. It's like, you know, this started in the fall and we've continued it all year. Mm-hmm. And it's something that it's clear. I mean, I certainly enjoy, Tom enjoys, and everyone else we've sort of welcomed into this little music community that we have. Everyone's really into it. And I think that it's, it's this idea of being welcome and being wanted, and like being wanted for my contribution.
And so taking that forward, like next year, if you're working in this school, how does that lesson kind of transcend this experience? I mean, or does it? I often operate under an assumption that we bring it all with us into the classroom.
Right, right. I mean, I think that it then comes to this question of like, you know, creating community in your classroom and creating, you know, a safe space, and which again are these kind of terms, these kind of
cliches. But not for everyone, I think, is the other piece. It's like in this community, right, we talk all the time about creating community and respect and those pieces.
Yeah.
But it's not, sadly, the conversation that happens in many schools.
Yeah.
Very true. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, it is cliche, in these three buildings that make up our campus.
Right.
But I think in every school building around the country or around the world, not a big conversation that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting that we are sort of having this conversation in the vein of music and talking about your experience as a musician. I'm having fun listening to you talk about it just because it's so entirely different from mine.
Yeah, because you last week were talking about Scott also. I don't know if you're going to say this. Scott also is a musician, and this year has been working on doing some arranging of pieces.
Yeah.
Hello.
The development of my musicianship, I play guitar and piano and I sing in the a cappella group,
mm-hmm.
But the development of my musicianship from the very beginning was not formal, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have taught myself how to read music and all these sorts of the ways that theory works, not with teachers, not with any kind of formalized training. I was in choir in school. And so I guess we sort of learned that. But in terms of like learning how to arrange music or anything like that, it is so almost foreign to me. In that, to me, music has a particular energy that lends itself very well generally to improvisation and
mm-hmm.
collaboration in groups. At least the way that I like to play music.
Mm-hmm.
If you sat me down when I was 8 years old with any instrument and a sheet of paper and showed me how to read it and produce it on the instrument, I would have told you that it was no fun for me.
Mm-hmm.
I would have had no interest whatsoever, and I would have stopped. But instead of that, what ended up happening for me a little bit later in life, I was probably around 12, is I just picked a guitar and taught myself chords.
Mm-hmm.
And my awareness of, in the first band I was in, I was probably 14, 13, somewhere in that range, and my awareness of how music exists in that space of what we call a jam was extremely, extremely in terms of the way that you collaborate with the people in a group. It was extremely informative of my teaching practice, because the energy that you bring to the awareness of the dynamic of a room when music is happening that's improvisational, and dealing with like new things as they come along, and like improvising when problems come up, or when you make a mistake, or when a change occurs that you were not anticipating, that kind of energy happened to me all the time in my teaching
mm-hmm.
practice, almost chaotically.
And would you say that that's, because I would imagine the same thing happens when you're teaching German, or to some extent. So would you say that that's a kind of person that you both are, or that you have become through music, right? I mean, there's that element of...
I think that, like, so for instance, I was very similar to you in that I thought traditional school worked fairly well for me.
Mm-hmm.
But the ability to improvise and to, like, not necessarily hold on to a structure, I think, is something that I learned through music. I also learned, the appreciation of, like, really being able to separate from the page the product.
Oh, okay.
So, like... In my experience in choral groups, a thing that I think happens far too often is that if you know theory, you rely on theory to produce music. My personal opinion is that while I think theory is very important, I do not think theory is music. I think it's theory, and it is a part of this is part of the language of music and part of how it is produced, but to be a great theorist is, in my opinion, not what it is to be a good musician.
Yeah.
And I know some great, great theorists who are just like, and I'm not a good theorist, is it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, I
if you were great, maybe you're
yeah,
you would be different.
I mean, I think I would, frankly. Like, I think if I was a better theorist, I would not be as willing to do, it's like, I do things in the arrangements that I make that a music theory class would just tell you not to do. you know, but I'm just like, well, they're interesting and they lend themselves well to the song or whatever it may be, right? I know a lot of theorists who are, I think, great theorists who can run circles around you with regard to theory. You ask them about songcraft, though, or the energy of a band, mm-hmm. How that works, how to collaborate and improvise effectively. 'Cause it's not easy. Jamming is not just improvisation. You have to be feeling the energy of the room, the dynamic of the room. I know a lot of people who are great theorists who can't do that, who are even great like practitioners of their instrument, right? But they are terrible improvisers.
And so, kind of building on that, do you think, and you don't know, because you're a musician and you're bilingual, right? So in a classroom, how do you think that shapes your brain differently?
Great question.
Let's see how the answer turns out.
No pressure. But that was my best one.
God, I feel like I'm on fresh air right now.
That's what we strive for.
Bilingualism and improvisation. Well, I think that the way I've been taught and the way I've thought for a long time that I'm kind of questioning now deals with both of those things. Because, for instance, I grew up bilingually, but spoke very, very poorly.
You grew up with German?
With German. My father's German. But I've always sort of described it as, you know, he speaks this very heavy dialect from southwestern Germany. And, you know, it wasn't totally consistent, you know, especially as my sister and I grew older. You know, you become an adolescent, you're surly, your dad talks to you in German, you answer in English. And here he is also living, you know, three members of his family are Americans.
Right.
He's living in America, teaching at an American school. He's speaking English all the time as well. So, you know, at some point he's like, all right, well, screw you, I'm going to speak English too.
Right.
But then at some point I realized that I was in danger of losing my language, and this was also sort of the, you know, the beginning of adolescence, and I went to Germany and realized that no longer was I playing Barbies with my friends, which you can kind of like fudge your way through, but I wanted to start talking about boys and feelings and, you know, frustrations around 14.
Right.
Wasn't happening with my language. So I came back to the States, left my public school in Vermont for boarding school, and the prerequisite was that it have a German program. And I worked my ass off for 3 years, absolutely learning every rule there was in the book for grammar. I mean, just top to bottom charts for conjugation, for the different cases.
So structure, and rules.
For adjective endings. And the thing is, I mean, I do feel as though that learning that structure absolutely freed me. I mean, I had sort of the flow of the language already embedded in me, but I needed that foundation in order to have the confidence, first of all, and really to have the knowledge.
Wow, that is so fascinating.
Of the language. And the thing with music, I think, is really similar. And I do think that it is the way I was taught.
Yeah.
I had a classmate in elementary school who played fiddle. And my violin teacher once took this boy, Nathan, for a lesson. And Nathan had already, he had 3 or 4 years on me. I mean, he had started super young and was a really talented fiddler. But his father wanted him to learn how to read sheet music. And my teacher then took him and spent an hour trying to play a single bar, so we're talking four notes here, a single bar, took an hour to try and get him to play it in tune. And his hand position, it's just a different hand position, and so like completely different technique, which in my teacher's eyes was wrong for classical violin, which frankly, I would tend to say is wrong for classical violin. The wrist for the fiddle player is up against the neck of the violin. And you can't then really shift into the higher positions that you need for classical violin. So what I want to say with all this is that I feel as though, for me musically, I feel as though I'm able now to begin improvising And I don't think that I have yet sort of the confidence and the ability just to sort of like jump in fully enthusiastic. I mean, there's still definitely some hesitation and like trying to figure it out, and it's sort of slow coming. But I feel as though I needed those years of learning
and structure, scaffolding.
Exactly, you know.
That is so fast. Can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah.
So during this period of time that you were knee deep in books, right, learning the rules, every rule there is, you said that you feel like you needed that to have the confidence to kind of master your language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How is it that, like, do you recall a point at which you felt that you had achieved mastery of these things and felt that confidence in contrast to before? Can you recall a particular point or a rule or set of rules or a book that you finished and said, I'm done with that book and I know everything in there?
No, I guess I wonder where this fits in. I mean, the thing is, I was living for Germany for 4 years between undergrad and starting here. So essentially the last 4 years.
Yeah.
And the thing is, my German is great. My German is very, very good. All of my friends sort of assure me that I'm fluent and it's perfect. But I still, I hear every mistake that I make.
Uh-huh.
And when I'm unsure, when I've learned a new word, when I'm trying out a new expression that I've you know, heard someone else use, I get nervous. I don't like making mistakes. This is just something...
Well, and it's interesting is that... So there are a couple of pieces to that as you were talking, were kind of interesting to me. So you were talking about the boy who your teacher took on,
mm-hmm.
and you said he was a couple of years ahead of you and was a kind of proficient musician,
yes.
Right? And then there's this moment of him having to learn the way,
yeah.
Right, that your teacher says is the way to learn, and suddenly he becomes kind of incompetent,
yeah.
In that tradition. Like, he can make the music, it is beautiful, and it speaks. But there's still this moment of, but you don't do it the way that
we have been doing it,
right? And so there's that. And then,
yeah.
So him finding what it sounds like discomfort in that, and you finding, kind of articulating, finding intense comfort in, like, this is the way that we do things.
Yeah.
And so there's that, which I think is fascinating. But also, when I ask the question, I'm thinking of, like, your plasticity and ability to move, like, because you can switch between German and English,
mm-hmm.
Because you can pick up an instrument and you're, like, the kinesthetic ability is there, and, like, being able to maneuver and plan and hear things going on. And so that's what I'm thinking about. And you're talking about the way of learning and the way that your knowledge was shaped. And
mm-hmm.
it was just an interesting, like, contrast to how you took that question.
And I think one of the other things, and I keep... because we start off with music and my feelings on music are a particular thing. I'm also bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
And neither a musician nor am I bilingual.
I speak Spanish. But I was in an immersion program.
Mm-hmm.
And from when I was in kindergarten, so right around when I was 5, and I studied for about 10 years. I can't actively remember a time. I mean, I started around 5 years old. I can't really remember really well a time when I wasn't, to my perception, fluent in Spanish as well as English, except for now. I don't think I'm fluent now. I was when I was 15, and then I started to kind of lose it. But like, if you talk to most people who hear me speak now, they would say, oh yeah, he's fluent or whatever, right?
Uh-huh.
I don't think that, because I can tell that there are muscles that you use in certain languages that you don't use in English.
Yeah.
And like, I just don't have them anymore, and they used to be perfect. My grammar was beyond reproach when I felt really fluent. Now I would say it's not as good. But I did study from books, but it wasn't necessary for me. I find this really fast. Like, I didn't require the charts of verb conjugation.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I knew them on instinct when I was 15. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that's true. If I went back and like had to relearn, I know I'm not sure it was. I tried to learn a third language, Japanese, in that kind of like structured, you know, memorize things and kind of use the scaffolding way, mathematical kind of linear approach. I could not do it.
Huh.
I mean, I just utterly failed at learning Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
do you think that is because of the timing of learning, or do you think of that, like, so there's the situation
mm-hmm.
of it all, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, because we know how language acquisition
right.
works. Mm-hmm. Like, you were going to probably be better at learning German in high school because you had that early kind of way paved.
Yeah.
So do you think that that structure, when you were trying to say, I got these two, now I'm going to add the third?
I think there are a variety of problems. Number one, like, the structure of Japanese is basically entirely foreign.
Okay.
Like, in comparison to English.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, you can translate from English to Spanish pretty close to word for word.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Japanese doesn't work like that,
okay.
Right? So there's that structural element.
So the architecture
of the language is different.
Yeah.
It's a language that, you know, is Spanish is related to other Romance languages that I was at least somewhat familiar with in terms of the way they sounded. Japanese I was not. I also do think it was because of the time I learned Spanish when I was very young, and it was effortless.
Mm-hmm.
And then putting in the effort mm-hmm. of trying to learn Japanese was not fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought to myself, like, well, I just require immersion. Like, and I learned French around the same time,
mm-hmm.
Very temporarily, but I was conversational in French within 2 months of learning my first word.
Wow.
Also
in an immersion program, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I stole a lot of structure from Spanish.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I know, I like all this
right.
stuff is fairly transferable. A lot of words are fairly transferable. So it wasn't like I was going from nothing to conversational, and I was never fluent. But I had always used this kind of the rhetoric that I would use in talking to people about it, because I am half Japanese, and people would be like, well, how could you not learn Japanese? You learn these other languages.
Genetically, you're
predisposed,
yeah.
right? And that was sort of the thing. That, you know, they didn't necessarily say, like, you should be able to learn Japanese because you're Japanese, and it's like, you know.
But you can see other faces.
But you can see other faces, like, you learned Spanish
yeah.
and French. But I
so sad to your people.
right. But I think it's really fascinating to kind of look at these things, because I think it's a really fascinating lens about kind of that what I think is probably neurocognitive, sort of the tuning of your neurocognitive pathways,
mm-hmm.
and the way that people learn and the way that they use to learn different skills. I mean, like, you know, whether it's a language or whether it's music or whether it's anything, we not only do we have ways that we finely tune when we're young, in a sense, but I also think we probably get comfortable in those ways, right? Which comes
yeah.
back to what you're saying about, like, when somebody would ask you to improvise, even though you were fluent in the music,
mm-hmm.
right? When someone would ask you to improvise, it was a place in which you were not comfortable, sort of a context in which you were not comfortable performing, and thus there was that anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also an act of creation.
Yeah.
yeah.
Like, the improvisation, this is a place from which I can speak, is a place of creating from basically nothing,
mm-hmm.
right? You know you have the tools, but it's
yeah.
it's Legos.
Yeah.
And it, so it becomes all on you all of a sudden, right? The sheet
mm-hmm.
music's like, oh, somebody, like, and I took the road not taken.
Yeah.
And that has made all the difference. So is that a piece? Do you find yourself trusting yourself more as a musician as you improvise and as you jam?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it's such a nice feeling.
Does that go back to when you pick up sheet music? Do you feel different when you return to that kind of structure?
I've not really been playing much classical music, actually. Part of it is actually because I don't have a group to play with right now. I mean, the thing is, thinking about collaboration, some of my happiest hours have been spent doing classical chamber music.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's so much fun. It's
yeah.
I mean, and it's really similar. It's, you know, it's a similar process of music making.
How so?
Well, just, oh my God, the camaraderie. It's such good stuff. And I mean, when you get just a beautifully crafted piece of music that is so complex. I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, not at all to poo-poo the, you know, sort of the folk music improv that I'm doing, but it's much, much simpler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about playing in a quintet or a piano quartet or, you know, a sextet even, it's just, with all of those voices, it's just incredible what can be done when it's, you know, when it's all sort of
orchestrated
for you, mapped out.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's not, you know, it's not some dead process. I mean, you bring so much of yourself
nuance
to that music. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And knowing that certain styles of music, I mean, like Mozart as opposed to Brahms, is going to call for a different way of playing, it's very interesting to play with those expectations. Because you, of course, are all modern musicians and all individuals who are then also going to interpret what is expected from this music and from this composer and from the era in which it was written differently.
Do you think that's the same thing as when, and this is going to be the last question, because I just finished my coffee.
Okay. Oh, wow. That was quick.
I know. Well, it was lukewarm. So the way I internalize that is as a reader, picking up a piece of Hemingway versus picking up a piece of Tolstoy versus picking up Gertrude Stein or Austen. Mm-hmm. Those pieces are going to ask me, I'm a modern reader, right?
Yeah.
I could also pick up Tom Robbins
and
like breeze on through it. But there is a shift that happens when I pick up Hemingway that asks me to read differently.
Yeah.
Is that, am I this is me trying to make sense of a musician.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Am I picking up on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really an interesting way to think about it. And also, I think, an interesting way to think about walking into a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Like, as a person who, you went to public school and then did boarding school,
mm-hmm.
right? And we talked about urban environments versus not working in an urban environment
yeah.
and what that means. And it's kind of, where do you best play your music as a teacher is kind of an interesting way to think about that.
Yeah.
That is the end of our podcast, so it brings me, Scott, to an important question.
Yes.
What did you learn this week?
You know, I've got it set, and this is a really interesting thing that happened to me this week. So, I am, if you're an employer out there listening to the podcast.
Wouldn't that be great?
Wouldn't it not?
The one person who listens is looking to hire.
Yeah. So, we at this particular podcast, Learning Grounds with Zach and Josh, are looking... Or wow.
Your employment chances.
My employment chances just went way down.
Yeah.
With Scott and Zach.
There it is.
Because my name is Scott and he's Zach. We're looking for employment. Or I'm looking for employment. I can't speak for my esteemed.
Liz is too.
And Liz is also looking for employment. I can't speak for my esteemed colleague here. But, so I went to the career services office here at the Ed School and I spoke with Valerie Sutton, who's the head of the office over there, and I told her about my anxiety at putting myself out there, just like, you know, giving a pitch to people and asking for things like, you know, and asking your connections for references or to recommend you or blah 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 blah, whatever it may be. And she said to me, approximately, this is a paraphrase, I'm not quoting, she said, Scott, suck it up. And just get out there and do it, you know? Just ask people, cold email or cold call if you have to. Just put your name on an email list of somebody that exists and contact them and maybe they'll respond. And so I did that with a particular person and I thought to myself, and this is a fairly important person at a kind of really cool company, and I thought, oh, there's no way he's going to respond to me, you know. I'm sure he's way too busy, and I'll get a very polite email saying that he's too busy to talk to me. Within 15, and this was just an email to say, like, hey, I'd love to discuss my, you know, research with you and this and that. Within 15 minutes, he emails me back saying, oh, I'd love to Skype. This would be fantastic. I could learn a lot from what you're researching. And I'll CC the founder of my company, and maybe he'll want to talk to you. And just, like, so we set up a Skype call. And what I learned is that if you're willing to put yourself out there and take those risks in many avenues and in many kind of arenas, but in this kind of career arena, for those of you also looking for work, if you're willing to put yourself out there and on the line, you can reap a lot of rewards and benefits. So I recommend it. That's what I learned this week.
Liz?
Yeah.
What did you learn this week?
Well... Josh, was that your name?
Scott, I can't, it's just terrible. It's close.
We're getting you caffeinated coffee next
week. That's what I need. It's been a long week.
Yeah.
With cream.
Yeah.
Scott's story reminds me of also something that happened to me this week. Actually, just last night, I've been invited for a job interview.
Congratulations.
Thank you. At a boarding school, which, frankly, okay, I won't say anything about that. I don't necessarily... It was great for me as a student. I don't know that it would be great for me as a teacher. Anyway, I'm very excited to go there to interview. It's in Pennsylvania. And I got an email saying, here we cover 50% of a flight and 100% of mileage and tolls. I was thinking, well, the thing is, I don't have a car, so I'm still going to have to rent a car. And even half of a plane ticket is still well over $100, which I just don't have kicking around right now. And so I also called a friend from my program who has a lot of experience with boarding schools, and I asked him what I should do. And he kind of gave me some advice, which I was able to kind of boil down to be honest and friendly in writing back to them. And that's exactly what I did, saying, would it be at all possible to pitch in a little bit more? Because I'm sorry, but I don't really have that much money right now, and I kind of need some help. And I then also was emailed back by the head of school within 20 minutes saying, we'll see what we can do. And I think that, I mean, it's something that I'm thinking about too with creating these communities. And I think it's about like being real and being honest. And I think that I do that now with my fifth graders who I teach German to. And I only see them once a week, which is kind of a bummer because I'm only now getting to know them, and now we have like 4 classes left and then the school year is done. But I just think it's like, be real, you know, kids get it, and adults get it too, so be real with them too.
Be real with everybody involved.
Be real with everybody.
Adolescents don't get it, don't even try.
What did you learn, Zach?
So glad you asked. Mine is going to be technology oriented.
Yes.
Because I'm trying to jump in on this bilingual bandwagon.
Yeah.
I don't remember when I signed up for this or if I signed up for this, but I got an email today from a website called Duolingo.com. Mm-hmm. And they asked me, they said, you've been selected as a beta tester. And I was like, I don't remember asking, but sure. And I have this paper to write, so
you
sure.
You assume that you know what a beta tester is right. doing.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
Yeah.
That was a big thing.
And so I was like, I have a paper to write, so I would love to waste time. And so what this website does is kind of brilliant. And it's French, German, and Spanish. You pick your language. And they have these basic lessons set up. Basic vocabulary, spelling, those kind of things. And they utilize the microphone function of your computer. They have you type things, they have you listen to things, and then they have you like look at pictures and then type out what the thing is. So it's really interesting instruction. So you go through the lesson, and then they have a set of phrases or pictures from the internet that need translating. And so they get the pieces that are most linguistically relevant, mm-hmm. like leveled, mm-hmm. to help. So you're basically helping to translate the internet while you learn this language.
Wow.
Yeah. So I started today. I jumped in and thought, okay, we'll try this. I sat in the library. Every time I got to the thing where it says, read this sentence out loud. In the library, I started just speaking strange things.
Was this on the second floor? Because that's where it's most inappropriate to do that.
It's like, yo soy la niña.
Right.
People are looking at, you're not actually. but it was really interesting, and kind of I learned that this existed was my thing.
Right.
And the approach was really interesting for me, and kind of it was fun, and there's like a gamification aspect, which I'm kind of okay with. I earned little fake coins. That was nice.
That's fun.
But it was really neat. So I learned maybe I will be able to learn another language.
At your ripe old age.
Or three more.
Or three more.
I could get all of your languages.
I would really be interested in looking at that, because I was working, I was a translator for mm-hmm. the last 3 years.
Oh, okay.
I was in Germany. So I'm very interested in anything to do with that.
Well, Duolingo.com.
All right. That will be what I learned next week.
Nice.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much, Liz.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. It's our pleasure.
And thank you, anyone who is listening. We really appreciate it.
My mom and dad.
Oh, yeah. Dude, it's our parents all the time.
I don't think my mom knows this exists.
Thank you for listening to Learning Grounds with Scott and Zach. Our intro music comes from New Dance Boys Mission. It's called Intro, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. Learning Grounds is also under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. Say it 3 times fast. And thanks for listening. Thank you.